One of the reasons why I choose this book, I think I mentioned this to you before, but I think it's pertinent to do it again, is because, not only because it's a sort of manual and discuss the main theories in literature, but also because in some ways it's organized following the main philosophical idea of the 20th century. So it seems that Eagleton was suggesting that we can match one to the other. And if we explore the main ideas on literature, we can explore the main ideas on philosophy, which is, well, it's practical perspective. I'm not quite sure if that is true, because there are several ideas on philosophy that have been explored here. But what we can consider as a valid hypothesis is the fact that all the connection between philosophy and literature has been explored. So as far as I'm concerned, the book is okay, because as well it's organized chronologically speaking. And this is why he starts, if you want, chapter 2 with the idea of phenomenology, hermeneutic, and perception theory, who are three theories who are the same theory, if you want, in one way or the other. So let's start. Let's give you a quick picture of. There is a German figure called Hegel. You know him? Heard something about? What do you know about him? Nothing. You?
Dialectic history, isn't
it? Yeah.
Nothing complicated.
I read it.
Marx and history and
stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, always he has been quoted as one of the sources or one of the roots of Marx thinking and modern thinking as well. Well, Hegel is important in philosophy because he created this idea of dialect, the idea that the way in which you think is you have one hypothesis or one premises, second premises, and then you have the conclusion, if you want. But what is important is this logic was already present in the Greek period. You see Aristotle and other people. But what he made is he generalized this and applied to society. So he says, this is the thesis, this is the antithesis, and this is the synthesis. Right? So this is called a dialect, and this is the way in which people try to explain society. You see, you have one particular period in history in which is the thesis. You have the other who is the reaction, the contrary, and then you have the synthesis. You see, this is the way, this is what Marx picking up from Hegel. And Hegel as well is considered in some ways the father of the phenomenology. Why? Because before Hegel, if you want, in philosophy, or even after, the way in which we talk about something which is called a theory of knowledge. So this is a part of philosophy who refers to how we understand, how we know what we know. You see? So that is what we're talking about now here. And Hegel modified it. During the, let's say, the medieval time, for an example, someone like, let's see, Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, okay? For him, knowledge and truth, because for him we're more or less the same, was a relation between a subject and an object. Okay? So that was the idea of knowledge. So you have a subject here, as if I say a human being, you have an object here. So the relation between the two, in one way or the other, is what was considered knowledge. But was this or was this? You see? So the emphasis was placed on this side, or the emphasis was placed on this side. Another discussion about theory of knowledge previously has been addressed in that way. What Hegel introduced, and why Hegel called phenomenology, it says the theory of knowledge even if you want a theory of truth, is here. Is the phenomenon. You see, it's in the middle. It's a sort of things who is a becoming, a constant becoming. It's not something fixed. It's not something that you produce an action and then you have the effect as you was believed before. No. That in reality do not exist. Always in reality we work in this way. Which is, if you want, is in this way, you see. There is an author in the 19th century called Vico, Gian Battista Vico, who created a theory of history. He was talking about corsi and ricorsi. This is more the idea that he was having. We never have a start from a pure environment. We always start somewhere. So, phenomenology is this idea, is the idea that always you have, number one, several elements to consider. Number two, these elements are not static. They are in constant movement. And number three, you never can isolate a particular moment to say, you cut here and say, that is my subject, that is my will. You never can do that. To address that problem, Hegel was talking about this idea of phenomenology. You see? Since then, this idea has been evolved in philosophy. Different people have been discussing, probably the more notorious for you is Marx, who picking up quite a lot of idea of Hegel and apply specifically to history and economics. And what is, if you want, another key figure in this idea of phenomenology is someone who is called Husserl. Husserl probably is even more important than Hegel because Husserl, in one way or the other, put to the extreme this idea of phenomenology in the sense in which Hegel was describing general elements like a history, like a human being. What Husserl did is as well he applied this to the psychological dimension of the human being. So he tried to explore the psychological behavior of people using this idea of phenomenology. So basically what is important in phenomenology is the idea of process, if you want. We don't have, let's say, we don't have these static periods. We don't have static objects. We don't have static knowledge. Everything is an interaction between an individual and an object, between an object and individual. I mentioned the theory of knowledge because every time you want to know a particular idea in philosophy, the better thing to do is just to pick up one aspect of philosophy, not the whole philosophy. But I think theory of knowledge is the part of the philosophy who allow people, even people who don't have idea of philosophy, to understand more quick that particular theory. You see? So if you understand this simple idea, you understand phenomenology. Of course, phenomenology is hell complicated, more on that. But this is the whole idea. And this is what is really important to consider literature, because you don't need to be an expert in philosophy to understand the theories of hermeneutics, an example. See? So as far as you understand this, you know that you cannot be wrong in understanding what is hermeneutics, an example. And what is hermeneutics is a consequence of phenomenology. Why? Because hermeneutics, as you know, the roots of hermeneutics is interpretation. Hermeneutics means interpretation of particular books. So, as you imagine, with a perspective like this one, in which you don't have a clear subject or a clear object, everything will be a matter of interpretation. Why? Because you don't have the certainty that one perspective is the right one. You need interpretation. Interpretation is the key to understand nature, to understand knowledge, to understand other people. So basically, what hermeneutic is an extreme version of phenomenology. In which the emphasis is going to be place, if you want, let's call, in someone call it the observer, or if you want, the reader. Okay? Why? Because probably the easy way to understand this process in which either the subject, either the object are not very clear. Probably the only clear things that we can have is that we have a reader. We have a reader who have an idea about literature. We have a reader who have a particular way to see things. So we can be certain, at least, that what are these, you know, what is the framework of the reader. And this is why hermeneutics basically means that, means number one, interpretation, and number two, place the emphasis on the reader, if you want, in one way or the other. So, in one way or the other, to make things simple to you, all the theories about hermeneutics are theories about the act of reading, especially in literature. Of course, hermeneutics is getting complicated, and you can have more subtle perspectives. The best book about hermeneutics, which is could be a difficult one, but not that difficult, that if you have time, I advise you to have a look, is called Pamp Errasit, from a guy who is very, very interesting philosopher, Paul Collier, Paul Ricoeur. These are three volumes, has been translated into English, I believe. And he discussed this idea, discussed from the hermeneutic point of view, if you want, this idea of time in relation with narration, if you want. But as well, the book discussed everything, discussed the idea of history, discussed the idea of literature, discussed the main theory about the act of reading, an example. It's a very, very long book. You need to read the whole book, but you can pick up things here and there. Because, an example, the first volume, there is a long discussion about the Aristotle's and the Greek period. You don't need that, probably. But you can go, an example, in the second volume and the third, in which there are a specific discussion, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 pages, about a particular author, or an example about the act of reading, which is a theory within literature, as we are going to see. So that can help you. Or whatever thing you find about him, let's say a general introduction about Ricoeur, can give you a picture about that. There is another interesting author, he's called Hans-Georg Gadamer. But this is slightly complicated, because his contact with literature were near to zero. So his pure philosophy. He have a book which is called Truth and Method. And he is the one who create this idea, well, discuss this concept, Verstehen. What is in German that? Yes. So this idea of understanding. You are going to see probably here in this book or another the idea of Verstehen. But this is the idea of understanding. We need to understand how people understand. If we do that, we have the key of understanding, if you will. You see? That is the principle of hermeneutics, if you will. The whole thing about first thing has been discussed in this book. Very, but not that long, but slightly complicated. And also because translation has been not that very good. Now there are two or three new translations from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the States. Slightly better. But not that, so probably the best thing is to read it in German. My advice to you is much simpler. And he himself as well discussed a little bit. So this is a quick picture of what has been understood as a, if you want, phenomenology and then hermeneutics. And what is called reception theory is a consequence of hermeneutics as well. He is connected with a guy who is called Jos, Hans Robert Jos. Very, very interesting. Even if it's not trendy anymore, this theory of literature was trendy during the 80s. I think it's a damn good theory. It's very, very interesting, and allow people to think about literature in a very simple way. The theory of this guy, we can say, let me put it this way to make your life much simpler. If you want to see the version of hermeneutics within literature, this is the one. Okay? So to put a more simple way to you, reception theory is the version, this is the literary version of hermeneutics. Okay? What is reception theory? It's very simple. You understand literature in relation with the reception of a particular work. Let's say, for instance, you want to understand Eagleton book. More than go to see the argument of Eagleton, indeed you need to do that anyway, but more than that, you try to understand the reception of this book. How this book was read in the first instance. Who did it? When? What the review were saying about that? So, when you have that information, that data, you contrast then that with the content of the book. And then you have the right interpretation. Well, so to speak, the right interpretation. And there is a long discussion on why this is important, on why it's relevant. But what is more important, Jos made the point that in literature we cannot have true. In literature we don't have one truth about a particular. We have certainty about things. And what he was saying is that with the reception theory, probably we have the most accurate picture, because the reception theory tried to combine the majority of the elements. I mean, as more element as possible, in the sense in which we do not talk anymore nowadays about an author and a publisher. We talk about readers. We talk about a market. We talk about a different theory that the reader, or if you want, the author addresses when he's doing the book, and so on. So, what Jos was trying to do, these theories came from late 60s and middle 70s. The main book is, I think, is from 75, which is, I think, is published in... The guy was working in Constanza, in Germany. The first edition are 3 volumes. They have been badly translated at the beginning of the 80s and better later. But to my knowledge, in English, there are only anthologies. Some of them good, but never the complete works. However, these anthologies are well comprehensive, so you can have a clear picture. But what he was trying to do was try to address the fact that we are living in modern times, that we do not do literature in the 19th century way. Because what he was saying was, until the Second World War, we acknowledged that we were having avant-garde, we were having new aesthetical movement, we were having new ways to produce literature, but the critics were remaining with the mentality of the 19th century. And he says, we need to address new issues within literature. Market, how the author discusses literary theories that never happened before, the idea that we have readers now who already have an idea about literature when they face a book, and so on. All these issues are relevant and are important to understand the idea of literature that we have nowadays. So he says, for address these issues, we need a new theory, and that was called, he called, reception theory. Paul Ricoeur and Temple Hesid discussed the reception theory. However, the best thing to do is to go to see Jos straight away. I believe in the library there are some German versions if you want to read. If not, there are good translations in French and recently better translation into English. Anthologies, I mean, because the original publication was huge, so they're picking up the more important articles and they put in anthologies. So that is why these three phenomenology and hermeneutics and reception theory work together, because philosophically speaking, they are the same. They are different versions of the same idea, you see. So, as you imagine, in philosophy, reception theory was not that popular. Nowadays, that changed, but was not that popular. Hermeneutics was slightly much stronger, because Gadamer, and because everyone who was working with hermeneutics referred to the phenomenology of Husserl. So that was, let's say, a strong school within philosophy. Now, what is important about phenomenology and hermeneutics is probably the last theory or the last school who was trying to give a comprehensive idea about knowledge. Okay, this is what is as well was so popular in literature, because people like Gadamer and Husserl were classic philosophers. They were trying to give a philosophical theory who will give you an explanation about almost everything. All right, and this is the way in which this modern, postmodern thing start to be discussed in one way or the other. The modern perspective in philosophy is referred to those philosophers who try to explain everything, you know, and everything means nature, human being, relation between nature and human being, and so on. So, give you a comprehensive theory about almost everything. Postmodern people say that is impossible. We cannot achieve that anymore. We have only local explanations about a particular phenomenon, and that's it, you see. So, either you're picking up from a modernity point of view, either you're picking up from a postmodern point of view, or the author. I read that this probably was the last school who attempt to give this very comprehensive and holistic, as they call it in philosophy, explanation. So, as you imagine, for literary critics, this was poetry, this was music. Because if you have, number one, a theory of reading is important. Number two, a very comprehensive theory, then you are, that is ideal for literature. And that is why reception theory was huge, immensely popular among literary critics during the 70s and during the 80s and even at the beginning of the 90s. And I think still, to be honest with you, I don't think it's the best, but it's still pretty much one of the few theory who really is easy to explain, is easy to apply, is easy to use, and the results are good. Because to my knowledge, there are not that many theory who consider all the elements that nowadays we need to consider. Let's take, for instance, the idea that we have a book, that the book is an object, that the book is have a market, the fact that then probably we need to talk about an author, about a narrator, that we need to consider the content of the book in relation with what has been done before in relation with some content, that we need to consider the fact that this author maybe was author of other books, and so on and so on and so on. All these issues, to my knowledge, were not considered at the same time by other theory. To my knowledge, reception theory is the only one who attempt to consider all those elements. Not necessarily because they in one way or the other, they analyze all of them, because that would be impossible, but at least they acknowledge that they consider some of them and they ignore the others, and therefore they have the consequence. More important is something that was working in science before, but I think works as well nicely in literature, is that you need to consider, when you consider literature, two contexts. The context, if you want, of reception, and the context of production. And this is interesting, because in the 19th century, meaning of analysis, especially applied to literature, for the author, this was the same thing, you see. They never make a distinction between the moment in which someone produced a book and the moment in which the book was read by someone. For them, it was the same. So they treat equally the view of the author about the book and the view of a particular reader about the book, without considering the fact that they were two different different level, two different moments. So, in one way or the other, yours force the people to think about this, to think that the moment, the context of production, the moment in which you produce a book is one thing, and the moment in which that book has been analyzed, has been discussed, is another completely different, done by different people, of course, as well. So, if you contrast these two moments, then you have a perspective of a particular book. And that is interesting, especially when we discuss, I don't know, I just give you extreme examples. An example, an author, a very famous author like Borges. One of the most famous books about Borges is called Fictions. This book was published in the middle of the 40s, during the war period. The first edition was 300 issues only. Took to the publisher, I think, to sell all this book near to 15 years. Okay? So now that book has been selling thousands and thousands of copies and is one of the classics in the 20th century literature in this planet. So, if you don't pay attention to the context of reception of the book, you are going to think immediately that that book, right from the first moment, was a bestseller and was a very famous, and everyone was accepting that book, and everyone was in agreement with that book. Wrong. That's wrong. And how you are going to know that? Because you apply these. You try to understand the context of production, so therefore you go to analyze fictions, and you are going to realize that the book had two parts. One part was already published, the other were new articles, and so on and so on. You do the analysis of that. But then, you are going to understand that the context of realization of these ideas were irrelevant at that moment, were not considered. And then you are going to see why. Why Borges' idea about fiction during the 40s, no one was paying attention. Why they were not popular, and so on and so on. And this is important, because this gives you the context of the author. If you don't do that, you are not going to understand later how the author was working. An example. The idea that we discuss something who is peripheral is an item that the postmodern critics like, pretty much. The idea that we don't have a center anymore. What is the center? Is London the center? Is Tokyo the center? Is New York the center? We, culturally speaking, we don't have a center anymore. So, now we talk about periphery. Depends where you are, we have different peripheries. Okay? So, the fact that Borges could be considered a peripheral author who has been, in one way or the other, using this peripheral idea of literature to generate a literature can be only understood if you understood this. Because if you see Borges as it is now, you are going to see peripheral. This guy is not peripheral. This guy is the top. He's selling thousands and thousands of copies. Always is in the mouth of everyone. Always is quoting. So what is the peripheral element of this guy? There is none. But yes, it is. But the only way you can figure out that is that. You see? So this is, according to yours, this is the way in which we try to avoid the misunderstanding, to believe that what we perceive nowadays from the commercial point of view of literature is what was the whole time, you see. And if we do that, we cannot understand the idea of evolution. And certainly in literature there is an idea of evolution. Things has not been the same all the time, you see. So I think that is the you don't need to produce an analysis of Poole, because that would be too complicated. But at least, if you acknowledge that this exists, at least you are not going to commit one mistake that always a student make, which is a confusion between the narrator and the author. Why? Because with this scheme, you are going to know very well that the author is one thing and the narrator is the other thing. And of course, the reader is completely different, even if the reader is the same author years later. Because you see, we start to discuss here something which is get twisted and twisted and twisted nowadays, is the fact that more and more, because commercial reasons, because intellectual reasons, authors try to create the context of reception, you see? Because with this theory, we can realize that. We can realize how a particular author was in one way targeting a particular audience. And not only that, was in one way or the other making a sort of ready-made interpretation of the book. I mean, if you notice nowadays, you have someone who publishes a book, and immediately that person have an interview in the media, and make presentation of the book and comments about the book. That is crucial for the author. Why? Because using that interview and using that media access, he created in the mind of the reader the first reception of the book, even before the people went through the book. So when you arrive to the book, you already have an idea about the book. Who gave you that? Well, probably the author. Then, it's so difficult to change that in your mind. It's so difficult. And that is when the authors are very clever, some of them, because they create this context of reception before the book arrived. So if you are a good or bad writer nowadays, sometimes it's a matter of marketing. It's not a matter of reading. Because to have a clear picture about technical issues, to have a clear picture about use of the language, you need 50, 60 years probably, or maybe more. And sometimes that's not even the case. So what you can have now immediately is this sort of reception. And this reception has been manipulated by literary agents, publishers, and so on. So the question is, how in the hell you are going to understand this if you don't have a theory like a reception theory? Because if you don't have a theory for you, well, this will be unnoticed. This idea, this public appearance of the author, this manipulation of strategy from the author with the reader will be not noticed, as was in the 19th century. I mean, the analysis is an example of Dickens. Within the 19th century, never considered these kind of issues. And indeed, if you analyze Dickens nowadays, well, you have several issues there. You have the problem of the money, the fact that the guy was running out of money constantly, the fact that at some point he was, writing just to get the money, the relation with the publisher, they always were chasing him, the fact that the publisher was cheating him in one way or the other, not giving to him all the copyright, and so on and so on. This is crucial to understand the way in which Dickens was writing. But this is crucial for us now. No one was paying attention to that because maybe it was too soon, or maybe because there was no theory to explain that. So one thing is certain for us. Whatever you agree or disagree with the reception theory, one thing is very, very crucial is that there are elements that need to be addressed, or elements who are there. You don't need to address all the elements, but you need to consider that those elements have consequences. Yes. Yes, exactly.
We do think of those things that is central for, how many books they sell, how much do they make, things like that.
Yes.
That's a response to
that. Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes, I mean, there are different interpretations here. There are authors who says that Yost at the end refine and make a sound fine-tuned to some Marxist idea. Of course, Yost, who is a very conservative man, will be revolt, listen this, but that is the truth, yes. This is one of the first theories who acknowledge the fact that we are living in a capitalist society in which we need to deal less with literature in the traditional way, less with artistic, but more with symbol, with signs, and with things who have a capital, but in culture thing, you see. The consequence of yours, probably, which is more momentary for you, is the theory of one guy who is called Bourdieu, who is probably the one who reformulated this in a broad sense in sociology. And Bourdieu have a book which is called Les Règles de l'Art, which is I advise you to read if you have the time. I think it has been translated into English, Les Règles de l'Art. And this is it. I mean, we talk about capital, but capital not only in terms of money. We talk about capital in terms of culture. You see? So what we discuss about a particular author is this. What is the visibility of the author? How the author is going on? How many books? I mean, copies, agents, all these modern issues. And if you want the roots of this perception of the culture, not necessarily about literature, but the perception of this idea of culture indeed is coming from a man who is called Benjamin. Probably Walter Benjamin, analyzing the modernity, is the one who acknowledged this transformation of our society from one society who was stable, was having a clear idea about what the cultural monuments were into a society in which not only the cultural monuments are not clear which one they are, but as well the fact that what is important for us, culturally speaking, sometimes is not visible anymore. And this is the other issue. We are living in an invisible society. What is a value for us more and more is not tangible, do not have matter. And this creates a lot of problems. Because you see, for the 19th century people, reality was associated with matter, with physical matter. You touch it, it exists. So that was reality, if you want. But when you lose that sense of reality into a realm who is not tangible anymore from the physical point of view, then when the problem starts. Not only for literature, for science, for everything. In literature, if you want, was less damaging this situation, because at the end you always can say, well, literature always have a war, and that war was an imaginary one. Yes, fine. But however, there is the other elements, the other element of which is the place of literature within culture. A culture who is a more visual culture than literary culture, and a culture who is more and more virtual, if you want, in one way or the other, because you cannot touch it. You see? Even now, the artistic objects, sometimes they may, the artist, disappear because they are performance. So they do it for 1 week or two or a month and just disappear. You just keep record or film or something like that. Even the relation, physical relation with the books is different. An example, before the Second World War, you produce a book and the book probably was having a life, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And when the book was not sold out, those books who were not sold, they were put in a second-hand circuit, if you want, in one way or the other. Nowadays, they produce a book. If the estimation of a publisher is not accomplished in the sense in which, in a certain period, the books are not sold out, they destroy it. The whole book. They don't send it to the second-hand book. They destroy it. Because it's a matter of space, it's a matter of money, it's a matter that they can make a recycling of the paper, and that is cheaper, and so on. You see, the notion of physical object from the artistic point of view completely changed. Or have a look what happened with your friends, or my friends as well. They picking up books, which is, we can call it bestseller, they never keep it. They trash it. Or they give it away. How many libraries of bestseller books do you know? I know one or two, because people are academics and they are obsessed with this. But all the other people, the ordinary readers, they don't keep the books. They trash it. I mean, they trash it to the bin. They give it to someone, or they exchange it, but they don't keep it. Why? Because the sense of art in relation with literature has radically changed. So the emphasis, again, Yauss, I think, was right. The emphasis, again, is on the reader. Is in what you can get, is in your interpretation. It's not anymore, if you want, in the value of a particular physical object. The value now is not visible. The value is, an example, you go to a social occasion and you quote five times Freud. I don't know. So someone will be acknowledged that you dress Freud somewhere in your life. I don't know. You see, these kind of things are what are values, are not tangible. For people in the 19th century, to some extent, this idea of library, this idea that you go somewhere and you have all the books, was having connection with this 19th century idea, with the fact that if something is really good, we should keep it, physically speaking. We should keep a book. What happened with the libraries now? They trash the book. I mean, libraries in London, for example, they do not accept any more books, excluding special cases in which they have already the author and so on. I mean, for my colleagues, or even for me, who try to, I don't know, say an example, one student contact you and say, okay, I will be putting a copy of my book in the British Library, for example. They don't accept it. They don't, because they don't have space, because they, you see, this idea that we should be keeping in some kind of museum or library the objects who are, for us, culturally speaking, valuable, that just is gone. Because what is valuable for us is imaginary, it's not anymore physical. So that completely radical changed the idea of literature, completely, in the sense in which we do not create literature to generate culture. Culture go far beyond the idea of literature. Literature became one of the elements of the culture. This relevance that within culture literature was having in the 19th century is gone. A writer is still pretty much a very important person, if you want, in one way or the other. But this is for commercial reasons, not because for artistic reasons. Because nowadays, probably, the equivalent of the 19th century writer are the pop stars, probably. Questions? Yes. Yes, I mean, I mentioned Benjamin because Benjamin was the one who really is the one who make... No, this is not... this way. Adorno is l'enfant terrible, if you want, this group of people that we can call School of Frankfurt. Okay? The School of Frankfurt was a sort of group of people, philosophers, sociologists, who started to work in Germany during the 30s. The majority of them grew up with the Republic of Weimar, intellectually speaking, who, as you know, was in a very interesting moment in Germany, because all the changes and all the crisis and chaos that moment during the 30s and the 20s produced within the German society. What this school was doing is, well, they have different philosophical sources, but basically they were reading Marx and they were trying to reconvene Marx with ideas of the, let's say, 20th century. Let me put it this way. Marx had two main big ideas, if you want. One is connected with a theory of history, how history developed. Marx was saying we have periods in history, following Hegel's perspective about thesis and antithesis and synthesis. Marx was saying we have this same period in history. So Marx was saying basically that we can approach history establishing these different stages, if you want, in one way or the other. He classified this according to the way in which production, economical production, was done. So he was saying we have primitive society. We have a primitive society who could be, I don't know, the medieval time, if you want, in one way or the other. Then we have, in one way or the other, it was prehistory, if you want, primitive society. We have the agricultural society, society in which the way to produce things was grounded in agriculture, and that probably is medieval and early modern, if you want. Then we have, if you want, capitalism, who the way to produce is grounded on, if you want, money or financial. And then you have the final stage, which is he was associated with the revolution, in which will be a natural consequence of all the contradiction of those periods. Okay? So for Marx, the idea of revolution was, okay, could be produced using violent ways, but it's a natural historical consequence, and that when Marx was wrong, because naturally revolution do not happen. But according to Marx's notion of history, yes. So what happened is the School of Frankfurt were acknowledging this perspective of Marx about history, and he tried to reformulate, knowing that Marx was wrong, but knowing as well that Marx was right in several other issues. An example, Marx's idea was like, this is a building, well, this is an interpretation from Althusser, who is a neo-Marxist in the 20th century. For Marx, this is our society, okay? This is the infrastructure, and this is the superstructure. So, in society, we have the superstructure. We see the superstructure of something, culture. But what is important to understand society is what is the infrastructure, what is behind, and that is economics. So according to Marx, every explanation about society within the capitalism should be done according to the media of production. Alright? So that was not necessarily right as well. But, however, the idea that we can analyze society in such a way give to the people of Frankfurt some notion of sociology. So, to some extent, the school of Frankfurt are the ones who establish, if you want, in a more institutional way, in a more clear way, in a more comprehensive and solid way, the idea of sociology. Because you can refer the idea of sociology to people like Durkheim in France and so on, so that we talk about 1870, but that they were authors. This school is the first one who massively say, this is sociology, this is the connection with philosophy, this is the connection with literature. And sociology is fundamental, because without sociology we cannot understand modern society. And that was a Marx point of view. The only problem is that Marx was associating that perspective with history in the 19th century sense of the world, without noticing different changes. So, what the School of Frankfurt did is revamp a little bit Marx, acknowledging that technological changes have happened, that society is far more complicated than what Marx was saying. And they create a theory, well, different theory, but basically you can have two main authors. One is Adorno and the other is Horkheimer. They wrote as well together. And Benjamin, which is the third author, if you want it one way or the other, was a little bit separate, because they were discussing things and more important, when the wars came over and the Hitler period came over, these people went to the United States. But Benjamin commits suicide. That's the reason why Benjamin is regarded as someone who was part of the School of Frankfurt, but not necessary. And also because Benjamin's ideas were less formal. Benjamin was a thinker. He was thinking, giving ideas, theories, one after the other, after the other. These people, they were more academics. They were more structured. They were just giving more. And of course, this is the, if you want, the main thing. They were introducing as well some idea of Freud, some idea of Carl Jung, some idea of psychoanalysis into the sociological analysis, which is as well was new. And also they were trying to address a sort of theory of the culture as a relevant to understand our society. And that was the first attempt to do that from non-historical point of view. And that was very important, because all the idea of culture coming even from German authors from the 19th century were grounded always on history. An example of Spengler, always Spengler. But this is the one, this school is the one who tried to do that without taking a shortcut to history. Right! What do you think? It is clear, more or less? It's just to give you a panorama, alright? Okay, so see you at 11 and we discuss the text, alright?